difficult, but he was outspoken and courageous, and he had a philosophy that was in accord with most of John Collier's philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And so, that was the situation. This was the relationship between Willard Beatty and me, because I had written textbooks with Willard Beatty before coming into the Indian group. And so I had a little edge on rapport,
mm-hmm.
and knowledge of his views, and in a position to implement them,
mm-hmm.
and carry them out. So that when I got the general idea and was in accord with it, and we had a relationship where we were completely frank with each other.
And so
when we reached a point of mutual understanding, then I was in a, and he could come out and talk to me, and I could report back to him. Weaknesses, shortcomings, need for money, what can we do to beat the game?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's
some roses.
Well said.
You
beat
see.
The game, sure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Right.
And so there were really just three of us that were in this relationship and position in the course of time. There's Willard Beatty, I've already explained my relationship, and then Hildegard Thompson.
Yes.
She hadn't known him before, but he selected her, and she was had some experience as a reading specialist.
Mm-hmm.
And really the three of us that did what things were done in the Southwest, which weren't done elsewhere. Yeah.
Okay. Now let me follow this other tack through, and then I want to come back to this. One more thing on this business of line authority and so forth.
Yes.
Would you say then that the directors of Indian Education who came after Hildegard Thompson, Dr. Marburger,
the man who was now or was, he only stayed in a bureau for a year.
Yes.
And went to New Jersey. Can't think of his name at the moment. He's the state superintendent of education in New Jersey.
That's Dr. Karl Marburger.
Yes.
And then Charles Zellers.
Yes.
All right.
And I don't know Zellers.
You don't know him. Well, all I was going to ask you was, would you say that they were confined in the same way that Hildegard Thompson was?
They were in the same position.
All right.
And unless they were in harmony on a particular item with the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, he simply overruled them. I think these are one of the reasons why Dr. Marburger was only in the Indian Bureau for 1 year.
Yes. Yes. I gathered that. I read some correspondence that Bob Russell wrote to Dr. Marburger, and that was the indication.
Yeah. But I can't say positively, because I only talked to him once or twice, and he was really on his way out at that time.
Well, he wasn't like Hildegard Thompson. He couldn't
even
try
to act. No. But this explains why the Hildegard, I think it partly explains why such things as the General Accounting Office is now reporting Hildegard was able to express the fact that we have 10 years or 5 years in which to make some progress regarding dropouts and academic achievement, but it wasn't really realistically implemented.
Okay. All right. Now, let's go back to your education.
To what?
To your education.
My education.
For the Bureau.
Yeah.
Can you give me a little of your background?
Well, I don't know that it's particularly pertinent. People used to ask me, well, they still ask me this question, as though I were born in the Indian Bureau.
I certainly hope not.
I could have pinched myself 1,000 times if anybody had forecast such a thing. I went to Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, and a Bachelor of Science degree, and majored in the physical sciences. Because I was training as an administrator in the biggest brass company in the world, Waterbury, Connecticut.
Wow.
However, because of the World War I and the like, I was out for a year, and then I came back and speeded up and finished my work in 3.5 years, meaning that I got out in the middle of the year, which is an awkward time to find jobs, and we had a minor depression at that time.
And
that was in 1920, depression right after World War I.
Mm-hmm.
And my college president urged me to go up to St. Paul's School, Concord, New Hampshire, with one of the wealthiest clientels in the United States. The real old-time wealthy people, the descendants of Alexander Hamilton and the like, you see?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I found myself embarrassed because I'd never taken education. School teaching was the last thing that I ever thought of. And I really didn't even want to go up. But I was young, and he kept asking me, "When are you going, George?" You know? And I went up, and they offered me what in those days was so much money for playing tennis with the kids, you know, canoeing, baseballing, hockey, things I generally paid to do.
Right.
And a chance to read the books I'd been too busy to read just because of these things. And so I was hired, or I said I would come for the rest of the year only to teach the science. And then before that was over, through one of my professors, another extravagant offer came to me to another private school. It was so much I couldn't resist it for a while. I still didn't have. I wasn't the opening that I had trained for in a brass factory was I could have had, but it really wasn't. Times weren't right for it.
Uh-huh.
So I think I'll buy another one. I wrote and indicated the least salary I'd take. I thought that would settle the matter. I'd get off the embarrassment. But it didn't.
Wow.
So, therefore, I decided, George, you don't know what it's all about, this school business, and you either ought to get out. I knew that much. or start learning something about it, see what it's about. So that's when I took my master's degree. And then, of course, that opened a lot of vision to me. I had my own experience as a youth. I wasn't unhappy, but I could recognize many of its shortcomings.
Mm-hmm.
And so I began working on these terms instinctively, I guess, in relationship with the pupils. I was only a few years older than they were anyway, you know. They were 19, I was 22. So one thing led to another. And so I spent 17 years actually teaching the wealthiest children in the country, the Rockefellers and Alexander Hamiltons and the like, in a number of different schools, all high-rated schools, and I had quite a bit of administrative responsibility and experience besides science, mathematics. And it was because of my innovative work that, again, one thing led to another, and I went to Western Reserve Academy in Ohio,
mm-hmm.
and was one of the early experimenters in consumer education and mathematics applied to functional, everyday living situations.
You got involved in what they now term progressive education?
So then I became, through this, not until this time, that I become involved with the progressive education.
Ah, I see.
That was primarily because I decided that I would like to take some more work, graduate work, at Columbia University, where I specialized in curriculum. I was one of the first curriculum specialists, because there wasn't even such a category then, you know. They had mathematics and foreign language, but there was no such thing as a curriculum man in those days. And therefore, I got a job under Willard Beatty in Bronxville, New York,
I
could commute to Columbia.
Yes.
And this led to my writing mathematics textbooks and some involvement, not in any official capacity, but I would say spiritually, not without some ifs and ands, you might say, and buts about it.
Sure.
And Willard Beatty became president of Progressive Education Association.
Yes.
And so when he was selected as
director,
as head of Indian Education, he started persuading me to join him for a couple of years. He thought maybe there's a little job I might do in making mathematics more functional for the Indian kids. All the textbooks were about interest and real estate and business, and the Indian children had no experience with such things. It was meaningless to them. And so this is why he invited me into the Bureau as the first and last and only curriculum specialist for the Indian Bureau. So
you were at Bronxville.
And so I came into the Indian Service from Bronxville.
I see.
Now that was the only public school I ever taught in. But it was somewhat like, it was a clientele somewhat similar, not quite as wealthy, top management, but not old-line capitalists in Bronxville.
One peg down.
For many years, well, I've been in the West now for 34 years. Nevertheless, for many years, almost every week in Time magazine was some of my former pupils being written up.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah. Well, I didn't mean
that,
to speak
no,
so long.
That's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, you asked me a leading question.
I sure did.
So, actually, my coming into the Indian Bureau, I resisted, like even becoming a school teacher for several years. And I didn't know anything about Indians, and I was on Main Street. I had no real interest. And so I took the assignment for no more than 2 years. A lot of things happened subsequently.
Yes. Did you have was your first direct assignment based in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, but I actually got a permission to set up my office, my own office and residence in Lawrence, Kansas.
Oh.
Because I traveled the Indian country for nearly 3 years in a trailer. And so I could go out and stay on a reservation. My only assignment was, George, go out and find out what the situation is. And talk to anybody you want to talk to, the missionaries, the traders, the Indians, the old line government employees, the people in town, and taste and smell, and look at the geography, and find out what you can about the economy, what the Indians are thinking about. Why are they the way they are? What is their history? What makes them behave the way they do? And try to synthesize an objective understanding and restate the needs and their abilities to respond. Because the whole drive of the government, you see, the Indians were with the last one to know what their problems are.